Today, we are reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, chapter number 8, and text number 8. The chapter is titled, Dhruva Leaves Home. So, before we recite the verse, most of you will be familiar with these names in the verse. So, I'll just quickly give a 30-minute explanation for the verse, and then we'll recite together. So that you can recite with the understanding of the meaning itself, yeah? And the right place is on the board. So, Jai Utana Padasya. So, here we are talking about Ting Utana Pad. So, Utana Padasya. And Jaya means two. So, Utana Pad had something that was two. What was it? Suniti and Surichi. So, he had two wives. Suniti means Suniti and Surichi means Surichi. Surichi Prayasi Patyor. So, out of the two wives, Suniti and Surichi, Surichi was Prayasi. Priya means love or beloved or somebody more favored. So of the two wives, Surichi was more favored than Suniti to the Patyor. Patyor means Pati or the husband. So of the husband of the two wives, Surichi was more dear to him. Netrayad, and then Netra means Anyatra or the other one. In this case, Suniti yad Suto. Suto means son. So she had a son and his name was Dhruva. You get that now? Uttanapad had two wives, Suniti and Surichi. Of the two wives, Suniti was very dear to the king. Surichi was dear to the king and Suniti was not. And Suniti had a son whose name was Dhruva. Jai Uttanapad hasya. Suniti Surichi stayo. Surichi prayasi patyor. Netra yat sutu Dhruvaha. Jaya of the two. Of the two wives. Utanapadasya of King Utanapad. Suniti. Surichi. Tayo of both of them. Surichi. Prayasi. Very dear. Patyo. Of the husband. Na itra. Not the other. Yat. Whose. Sutaha. Son. Dhruvaha. Dhruva. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Prabhupada ki? King Uttanapadasya had two queens named Suniti and Surichi. Surichi was much more dear to the king. Suniti, who had a son named Dhruva, was not his favorite. The king sage Maitreya wanted to describe the pious activities of his king, of his kings. Priyavrata was the first son of Svayambhuva Manu, and Uttanapad was the second. But the great sage Maitreya immediately began to speak about Dhruva Maharaj, the son of Uttanapad. Why? Svayambhuva Manu had two sons, Priyavrata and Uttanapad. So just picturize this family tree. Yeah? So Priyavrata was the elder brother of Uttanapad. But Maitreya Muni here jumps immediately to the younger brother. Why? Srila Prabhupada explains. Because Maitreya was very eager to describe pious activities. Because in this Uttanapada lineage, there is Dhruva Maharaj. So Maitreya Muni wants to jump to Dhruva Maharaj immediately. Yeah? The incidents in the life of Dhruva Maharaj are very attractive to the devotees. Why are they attractive to the devotees? Srila Prabhupada explains. From his pious actions, one can learn how one can detach himself from material possessions. So it's attractive to the devotees because firstly, it enables us to detach from material attachments. And secondly, how one can enhance one's devotional service by severe austerities and penances. So two things happen. By listening to these pastimes, we get material detachment and spiritual attachment. In fact, Srila Prabhupada explains elsewhere that these two things happen simultaneously. Once we get spiritually attached, material detachment happens as a byproduct. Then what is the Phalashruti? What are the fruits of hearing to this pastime? Srila Prabhupada explains. By hearing the activities of pious Dhruva, one can enhance one's faith in God So first thing that happens, we get enhancement of faith in God from Shraddha. And one can directly connect with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and thus one can very soon be elevated to the transcendental platform of devotional service. So two things happens by in this Phalashruti. One, we get the Shraddha, the other one is Prema. So from Shraddha to Prema, the nine stages of devotional service. The example of Dhruva Maharaja's austerities can immediately generate a feeling of devotional service in the hearts of the hearers. How does this generate the feeling of devotional service in the heart of the hearers? We will discuss some of that today. Dhruva pastime is amazing. We'll try to elucidate on few of the subject matters that comes to my mind. Om Jnanati Virandhasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmane Shri Guruve Nama Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prestaya Bhutale Shrimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namine Namaste Sarasvate Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvisesha Sunyavadi Pashyatya Desa Tarine Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shri Vashadi Gauravakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So, this is a very famous pastime from the pages of Srimad Bhagavatam. Most of us are familiar with this pastime to some extent. And some of us may also have had a very in-depth study of this pastime. So as I said, there was a king named Uttanapad. He had two sons, Priyavrata and and Uttanapad had two wives, Suniti and Surichi. And we are talking about Suniti's son, Dhruva. One time, the king was sitting on his throne, and his favorite wife, you have to get the names in your head correctly so we can follow the pastime with the visualization of the family tree, of his dear wife Surichi. Surichi's son's name was Uttama. Okay? So Uttama was trying to approach his father, and he was trying to climb on the lap of his father, and his father was very nicely petting him, just as how we also like to cuddle kids, especially small children. They are very innocent, and their innocence makes them very beautiful and attractive. Children are very attractive because they are very innocent. You will not find pride and ego and fame, in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 year old kids. And because of lack of those demoniac qualities, they become very attractive to anybody, even if they are not our children. Yeah? We see a lot of time in the temple, devotees will mingle, and pamper, and show affection to small children. It's a natural feeling. In our temple, there is a Surabhi and Gokul, They are very attractive, especially also because these two kids are always there for Mangalarti. We get so inspired, by these glorious parents with glorious children, Never miss a Mangalarti for days. So they become very attractive, especially when they come very dressed and so much of enthusiasm at 4:30 a.m. in the morning. And when I look at myself, I just have to force myself out of bed to come for Mangalarti. But these kids are, so cutely running around in the temple. So very, very attractive. So we naturally become very, attracted to them. And talking about Surabhi, one time, with your permission, Mataji. One time, I was distributing Charanamrita, and as Surabhi and Gokul are, they are very eager for Krishna Prasadam. So they will run, and kids are okay. Srila Prabhupada said kids and old people can do anything. We can't. We have to, be within the laws of etiquette and morality and all that. Kids can do anything. So she came right in front, and she wanted Charanamrita. So I gave her Charanamrita, and she was not moving. And I was trying to think, why is she not moving? Because she's blocking the queue now. So then, no, the Paramatma told me that what Surabhi wants is there must be a tulsi leaf in her hand. Without the tulsi leaf, she's not moving. So I gave her a tulsi leaf, she immediately, you know, drank the nectar and then went away. So this is how the kids become so attractive, just by their innocent dedication, you know, to Krishna. So this, in this case, King Uttanapad was also showing his love and affection to his favorite wife's son, Uttama. Dhruva also tried to get the similar love and affection from his father. It's natural. When we come from office or from our workplace, kids run to the parents because they want that lovey-dovey kind of time, you know, that one-on-one with the father, with the mother. It's natural. So, Dhruva Maharaj was also seeking the similar affection from his father. Now, his father also wanted to reciprocate in the same manner. Again, it's natural for the father to show love and affection to his child, just as the child wants the love and affection from his father. It's natural relationship, natural feelings of the heart. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. But in this case, there was a third factor. The king was a little bit, not pessimistic. He was cautious. He was cautious that if he shows the similar kind of affection to Dhruva Maharaj, then Surichi will get annoyed. Because Dhruva is not Surichi's son. No? So I don't want to get into the wrong side of Suniti. And husbands know this very well. If you get on the wrong side of your wife, then you are in trouble. And in this case, there's double trouble for him because he has two wives. So because of the third factor, that I don't want to, you know, get put off Surichi, he withheld himself from expressing his natural love to his son. He had to control himself. He didn't allow Dhruva to climb on his lap, neither did he show any affection to him. So as a child, I mean, for that matter, even as adults, if somebody shows that kind of attitude to us, we'll naturally feel hate in the heart, correct? No? If we approach our close friend in the temple, and, you know, say, Hari Bol Prabhuji, how are you? After a long time, you know, I haven't seen you. How's it? And he just moves on without any care for us. Naturally, we'll feel a hate, right, in the heart. It's obvious. So just imagine you extrapolate this to a five-year-old boy, and that kind of behavior to a five-year-old boy will, of course, dismantle his own structure. You know, he'll feel totally devastated, and that's how he felt. Dhruva felt. Now, to add salt to the injury to this poor five-year-old young boy, what Surichi does, she shoots arrows of very, very harsh words to Dhruva. What does she say? She says three things. She says many things, but you can put it into three. Firstly, she says, you do not deserve this. You do not deserve this. Just get out of here. That's how we will say, you know, when we are angry with somebody, in our modern language if you like. You do not deserve this. Just get out of here. First thing. Get lost. That's what she says. I mean, this is to a child who has done nothing wrong. Secondly, she says that your mission is impossible. I'm not talking about the movie Mission Impossible. Yeah? In case your mind is wandering there, I'm still talking about Dhruva Pasna. Yeah? So she says your mission is impossible. Why? Because you did not take birth from my womb. No, you took birth from a maidservant. In case you still want to climb on the lap of your father, who is the king, who is my husband, who is very dear to, I am very dear to him, in case you want to do this mission impossible, then there is only one solution to this. You have to take birth from my womb. My womb you have to take birth. And to do that, to be able to take birth from my womb, because I am so glorious, and you can already picturize, right? She is full of what? What's the one word or two words coming out of your mind?
Pride.
Huh? Pride. Envy. She's just full of, it's like the venom coming out of the mouth of the snake. So she's in that kind of, that's a vigraha of venom, of pride and anger. No? So, she says that in case you want to, even notwithstanding that you don't deserve it, Notwithstanding that you are endeavoring on a mission impossible, if you still want to conquer this, there is only one thing you can do. You have to take birth from my womb. And to do that, you have to worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead so that you can take birth from my womb. Now, actually what he's saying, if you analyze this indirectly, what he's saying, not just get lost, but also go and die. How? Why? Because to take birth from the womb, he has to first die, right? First he has to leave this body. Otherwise you can't take birth from my womb. So indirectly she is saying, just get lost and die. Very, very, you know, a venomous person, if you like. You know. So that kind of treatment Dhruv gets from his stepmother. Now, if that was not enough, Dhruva gets triple whammy. Firstly, he is not able to sit on the lap of his father, first thing, which is his natural constitutional position, if you like. You know, it's the right of the son to be affectionate to his father. Secondly, he gets treated with these harsh, heavy words from his stepmother. Thirdly, his father keeps quiet. When our children, you know, are ill-treated, it is our duty to protect them. Children should be protected. Our parents should be protected. Prabhupada said five people should be protected. Women, children, elderly people, etc. So, here the king fails in his duty as a father to protect his son. Why? Because he is again very careful. If he takes the side of his son Dhruva, then Suniti will get upset. Surichi will get upset. So he doesn't say anything. So what does the poor Dhruva do? He goes to his biological mother, Suniti, weeping and his heart shattered, grieving, to say, this is what has happened. Her mother, who was the maidservant, as you know now, she did not know the solution to his problem. She did not know the solution to Dhruva's problem. No. How to put this young boy to get that love and affection that he deserves. Knowing that she knew she is a maidservant, so she's kind of like that, you know, not welcomed spouse. So she says two things, very, very important things. Both are very, very important, especially to the mothers, because she is a mother in this case. Now, we can equally extrapolate that to the parent, to the father as well. She says, my dear boy, do not wish ill on those who have ill-treated you. Because you can, if you picturize Dhruva's mindset at the moment, he's also full of anger and grieving and revengeful as well. No? So she gives a very, very important and very, very solid counseling. My dear boy, do not wish ill on those who have ill-treated you. Why? Because let them suffer their own reactions of their karma. Let them suffer their own reactions out of their karma. We do not have to deliver their bad karma. Let them suffer the way the Lord wants them to suffer. First thing. Second thing she says is that actually your stepmother's advice to go and seek the Supreme Personality of Godhead is not that bad. Actually, it's a good advice. So my dear boy, I confirm or I encourage you to take that path. Go to the path of finding the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And then he might give you the directions or the solution to your problem. So, with this, Dhruva Maharaj leaves home. And that is the title that Prabhupada has given to this chapter. Chapter 8 of Srimad Bhagavatam Canto 4 is titled, Dhruva Maharaj leaves home. So at this point, we are now at Dhruva Maharaj leaving home. In my story, not in terms of the pages of the Bhagavatam. Yeah. So Dhruva Maharaj leaves home. Then, when he goes to the forest, Narad Muni comes and meets him. How does Narad Muni know that Dhruva Maharaj has gone to the forest? Because, two things. Narad Muni is Tirkal Darshi. He can see past, present and future. So he's got that spiritual vision of what's happening. So he's immediately at the spot where where he can see some kind of bhakti sprouting. So he goes and, you know, flames that up. You know, that the flame for Krishna consciousness, if he sees that spark, He tries to convert them into a flame and into a big fire of bhakti. Yeah? So that's his duty as a spiritual master. So Narad Muni appears at the scene to Dhruva Maharaj. And what does he say? My dear little boy, you are too young for this mission that you have now endeavored. You are too young. Go home, rest up, grow up a little bit, and then you can pursue this path of finding the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So go back home. What does Dhruva say in reply? Now you may ask, why did Narad Muni tell him that you are too young? We are told from the pages of Bhagavatam again, Vaishnava Prabhupada many times, that bhakti is not dependent on time, place and circumstance. Bhakti is not dependent on birth. Bhakti is not dependent on race, on our greed, on our wealth. Bhakti is also not dependent on our age. Bhakti starts at any point in time. Bhakti should start at any point in time. So why did Dhruva Maharaj said you are too young for bhakti? You may ask. One time, somebody asked Srila Prabhupada that, Swamiji, what is the right age to introduce my child to Krishna consciousness? What is the right age to introduce my child to Krishna consciousness? So Srila Prabhupada said, what is the age of your child? And the mother said, 1 year. So Srila Prabhupada said, you are already 2 years behind. The child is 1 year old and he said, you are already 2 years behind. What does that mean? That Krishna consciousness for the soul starts at the point of union between the husband and wife. And that's why he gave this, the samskar of Garbhodhana samskar. When the husband and wife unite to get a soul in their life, and then through the process of this samskar, we can attract somebody who is very pious. So Krishna consciousness starts at the time of union, not after the time of birth. Then certainly 5 years is already too big. Why does Narad Muni say he is too young for this? So what does Dhruva Maharaj reply? He says that, my dear sage, the advice that you have given to go back and introspect and analyze this and wait, give it a little bit more time and continue, does not gel well with me. Your advice is wise, but because I am of a Kshatriya temperament, he's born in a Kshatriya family, son of a king, and because I have been hurt by the ill words of my stepmother, because I have not been protected by my father, at the moment this advice is not gelling with me. Please, my dear sage, give me another honest path. Give me another path that is also equally honest like this, but that can suit the time, place and circumstance where I am now. So what does Narad Muni say? Narad Muni says that, my dear boy, I reaffirm that the path that you are taking is appropriate. And then he initiates him. And then gives him the mantra that, go to Madhuvan, at the banks of river Yamuna, and chant the mantra Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Dvadakshara mantra is called, made up of 12 syllables. So go and chant this mantra Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. And in due course of time, if you chant sincerely, without envy, because Dhruva's again, his mindset is what? He's got that anger and the envy towards his stepmother. Why? How dare you deal with me like this, being a Kshatriya? So Narad Muni warns him, you chant this mantra without envy. Nirmatsaraya. Without any envy. And in due course of time, the Lord will give you darshan and your desires will be fulfilled. So Dhruva Maharaj goes to Madhuban at the banks of Yamuna River and takes Achman from Kalindi. Kalindi is the waters of Yamuna River. Kalindi Yamuna Jaya Jaya Mahava. So he takes the ashwan from Kalindi, sprinkles on his head, takes his bath and starts chanting Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Why did Narad Muni test? Why did Narad Muni tell him that you are too young for this? Because it is the duty of a spiritual master to test his disciple. How resolute are they in their determination to pursue Krishna consciousness? Or is he temporary enthusiastic person who will bloop out after some time? So that's why in our Krishna consciousness, initiation is given after a certain period in time. For that matter, even shelter is given after a certain period of time, and then we get initiation after a certain period of time. Because in this period of time, the spiritual master is testing his potential candidate or disciple to see whether he is genuine or just some showboated spiritualist who has come to freelancer, not very sincere. So that's why Narad Muni is testing Dhruva Maharaj. So a couple of lessons out of this. One, I've already explained that a spiritual master can test his disciple before and after initiation. So those of us are in either category, then just keep this in mind. Secondly, when our desire for Krishna consciousness is very strong, Krishna will automatically send us a spiritual master. Just as here, Dhruva Maharaj's desire to take the darshan of the Lord, albeit that his desire is adulterated, you know, he has got that material motive. Something he wants. He wants revenge from his stepmother. So that motive is there. Akama sarva kama. You know, he wants something that is akama, that is akama. He wants something for his sense gratification. Although the motive is adulterated, he still is on the right path of at least approaching the Lord rather than approaching anybody else. So, when our desire to approach the Lord is there, whether it's adulterated or unadulterated, the Lord will send us the spiritual master at the right point in time. A lot of time, in my limited experience as a Bhakti Riksha facilitator, people ask me, how do I get a spiritual master? And my answer always is, when your desire is sincere, Krishna will send you the spiritual master. So just be sincere. Because our relationship with the spiritual master is already confirmed. It's not that we get a new spiritual master in this age or something. That relationship is eternal. So just Krishna reintroduces us to that eternal relationship at an appropriate point in time. So, after testing Dhruva Maharaj, when Narad Muni reaffirms that your path is bona fide and I can see you are enthusiastic, please go and pursue this path of, and I'll give you this mantra, initiates him, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Dhruva Maharaj goes at the banks of Yamuna, as I said, and starts chanting this mantra. Now, Dhruva Maharaj exhibits a lot of qualities and characters, from the point of also being, a Kshatriya, a very strong temperament, a little bit envy towards his mother, especially towards his brother. After testing that is given by Narad Muni, Dhruva shows a very determined ambition. He comes across as very ambitious, and not just some loose ambition, very, very determinedly ambitious to pursue his goal. Yeah. So, this is the topic that I want to talk for another 15-20 minutes. About ambition. Again, in my limited experience being trying to facilitate few bhakti vrikshas, I come across many times when devotees ask me, and generally all these questions, I can put it in two buckets. Firstly, they will ask, especially those who show a lot of interest in Krishna consciousness, in bhakti, and those who have already taken few steps, of chanting few rounds, coming to the temple, doing some service, reading. In this category when we know that there is a higher taste, param drishtvan vivartate, we can get a higher taste in Krishna consciousness compared to anything else that we have so far experienced, then their question tends to be, Prabhuji, if I pursue bhakti, does that mean that I should not be ambitious in my workplace? Should I not be ambitious in my business? Should I not be ambitious in pursuing and developing the talents that is there in me? So should I just go to office and do my work and come back and don't actually, necessarily aim for promotions, recognitions, advancements? If I'm a businessman, should I just go and do my business without aiming for, increasing my portfolio? If I'm a talented singer or a talented speaker, should I not pursue all that because this may lead to pride? And therefore, should I just be kind of an average person and not be very ambitious? This particular bucket. The second bucket of question tends to be from those who are not so interested in bhakti, in Krishna consciousness. Their questions tend to be, if I join temple, does that mean that I will be a loser in the office? I will be a loser in my in my business? I will be a loser in terms of the talents that I have been given? So their fear is their material prestige and wealth and position and all that. And therefore Krishna consciousness becomes an inhibitor, if you like. It inhibits their progress towards material opulence. For the devotees, it's the other way. I want to become spiritually advanced, and those things can be, you know, an inhibitor in our life. So I don't want to pursue, should I not pursue those any further? Understand? So, to understand this, basically we have to understand properly what does ambition mean. From a spiritual point of view, to have an ambition in life means to use the talents and the skills that has been given to us by God, God-gifted talents, in contributing something meaningful to the society at large, and also as a service to the Lord. To be ambitious means to pursue our God-gifted talent and actualize it in the service as a contribution in the service of the society and to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You know, so very, very pure motive. On the other hand, a lot of time there's a misconception between ambition and greed. Greed means to be so highly ambitious with the view to accumulate so much of possessions so that we can gratify our senses out of those possessions. You with me? No. So our ambition can be materialistic and greedy. If we pursue it with the view to accumulate possessions from which we can enjoy ourselves. We want to buy one house, another house in Ruganina, then one house maybe near the temple, two cars, one good job, no. All these things we want so that we can come across as very, very great. Generally, this kind of ambitious goals can lead with a view to becoming very pride, no, very proud in the society. I am the greatest. One time, Srila Prabhupada was lecturing in Melbourne only, and somebody told him actually after the lecture, "Swamiji, I am God. And in 12 months' time, I will demonstrate to all of you that I am God. How great I am." Srila Prabhupada was very nonchalant about this. Very casually he said, "That's okay. Many people have that kind of desire. That's okay. Many people have that kind of desire." In other words, you know, you are just another of those rascals on the street, you know. You are on the wrong path. So, generally, you know, people want that fame and, you know, and prestige from their wealth. But a proper ambitious goal, Srila Prabhupada said that devotees should be very, very highly ambitious. We should be highly ambitious, and the best wealth that we can accumulate is, you know, the service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So a Krishna conscious motive, you know, and an ambition on this path is bona fide. Okay. So if we again, you know, analyze this in terms of different ashrams, you know, every ashrama has got its own prescribed duty. There is Swadharma and there is Paradharma. Krishna tells Arjuna in chapter 2 of Bhagavad Gita. No. Swadharma are those duties that are according to our ashrama. You know? And Paradharma is those duties that is according to somebody's other ashram's activity. So Krishna warns Arjuna not to do Paradharma, but to do your own Swadharma. Especially when Arjuna wanted to retire, you know, as a beggar in the forest. So Krishna said, "That's not your dharma. Your dharma is a kshatriya, and therefore you have to fight for the purpose of withholding the religious principles." So, as grihasthas, it is our swadharma, it is our prescribed duty to work. Now, we might be working in the farm or we might be working in the office. But the point is that a financial stability is important in a grihastha life. People again have this misconception that as devotees, should we even be earning money? Financial stability is definitely important, we cannot rule it out. And in order to have that financial stability in the family, so that at certain point in time we can perform our devotional service nicely, and at certain point in time in future we can retire with the wealth we have accumulated and continue with devotional service, that financial planning is important. And therefore, if working is devotional service, therefore we can also understand that having ambitious goals in the workplace, in our business, is also service to Krishna. Provided we dedicate those results in the service of Krishna and not for our own gratification. Yeah? People get confused a lot of time when Krishna says that karmanireva adhikaraste ma phaleshu kadachana. So people, the misconception that devotees have a lot of time is that Krishna is saying that, you know, we should not be attached to the results of our work. Karmanireva adhikaraste, do your duty, but ma phaleshu kadachana. Don't be attached to the result. So then we start thinking that, does Krishna say that we should not be attached to the result, therefore I should not have goals and directions, you know, and ambition in life? No, that is not the right understanding. That's not what Krishna is saying. Krishna is saying that we certainly should have goals. If you look at Arjuna, you know, when he's fighting in the battlefield of Kurukshetra, if he fights without any goal in mind, you know, then I have to win this victory, first of all. And secondly, if he does not have those sub-goals, today I'm going to kill Jayadrath, today I'm going to kill him. If he does not have that sub-goals in life, then he will not even win the war. He does not. Arjuna is not fighting the war very casually. He is fighting very, very enthusiastically with certain goals set in mind. The difference is that he's fighting with goals set, but he's not attached to the results of the fight. Krishna tells him that you fight with goals set in mind, be ambitious to win this war, be victorious. But whether you are victorious or whether you lose this war, that you don't be attached to, because that is not solely within your control. There are many other factors that will play a part in deciding who the eventual winner is. So that you leave it with me, with Providence. But you do your duty with goals. So in other words, karmanireva adhikaraste ma phaleshu kadachana means that we should be detached from the results of our activity, not necessarily detached with the activity itself. Being detached with the activity itself is a sign of irresponsibility. I don't want to fight this war. Oh, I will fight, but I will fight casually. Now, that is being very irresponsible. No. So be responsible, be being detached from the outcome. So similarly, in our case, when we have to, you know, pursue our talents, if we are God-gifted, you know, as a good manager, you know, we are good at managing things, and we are using it in the office, we are using it in the temple. If we are God-gifted in singing, we are singing at the temple, or whether we are singing elsewhere as our career, whether we are, you know, God-gifted in speaking, we are speaking, you know, in presentations in the office, or speaking Krishna Katha. So in either case, we have to be very ambitious in order to keep us, you know, increasing our talents to another level. But the point is to always utilize this in Krishna consciousness. Now, if you look at Arjuna again, when he was born, we all know that he was a super heroic, you know, in archery. Arjuna was not born with bow and arrow in his hand. I'm the undisputed archer of this world. He was not born like that. He was certainly born with the talent to become a very great bow and arrow, a fighter. Actually, he is called as ambidextrous. Ambidextrous means somebody who can do the same thing with both hands. No, I can write with this hand. I can equally write so neatly with this particular hand. No, I can drive with this hand. I can drive with this hand. I can do any activity with both hands. So that's ambidextrous. So Arjuna was ambidextrous. He could shoot like this or he could shoot like this. And you won't find many people who are ambidextrous. No, a lot of us write with this and then we'll struggle with our other hand. Even we won't be able to understand what we wrote. Our writing becomes very terrible. So Arjuna was ambidextrous. Now, he developed all these skills not by casually practicing, you know, how to fight with bow and arrow. He was very, very dedicated and enthusiastic in learning this art. At one point, when he came back home from the military academy of Dronacharya, his teacher, he was eating his prasadam, dinner prasadam. And when he was eating, all of a sudden there was a gust of wind, and therefore the flame, you know, that was producing light in the room got extinguished. And Arjuna was still eating. And he kept eating. He didn't need light to eat. So then the thought came to his mind that if I can eat in the dark, then I should be able to shoot in the dark as well. So that's why he's called Gudakesha, the art of, you know, mastering an object without any light, just with the presence of the sound. So that's when he started practicing at night. Whole night he will practice. Now look at him. Very, very ambitious person. But the point is not to become the, you know, the undisputed acharya, you know, archer of the world for his own prestige and fame, but with the view to become, you know, his prescribed duty, his swadharma is to be a kshatriya, and for that he needs to practice, and therefore he is not practicing only in the day but also in the night. Very, very ambitious, like Dhruva Maharaj, you know, seeking his goals. So he practices it, and we all know that this particular skill that he developed of being able to shoot just with the sound movement in the dark became very crucial at the time of the war of Mahabharata, when the laws of proper war were transgressed, you know, and generally according to Vedic laws, you know, a war is fought during the daytime, you know, and by the sunset it's all over. They are all again friends. So when the laws we started getting transgressed, then the fight continued in the evening and to some point in the night. And this skill that Arjuna has developed to shoot in the night became very, very vital, you know, for him eventually coming out as the winner. So, ambition with a view for contribution is not wrong. With ambition with a view for our sense gratification and enjoyment is not the right path. Now, our ambition can also be filled with envy. And that's why in this case, the genesis of Dhruva Maharaj's perceiving the path of Krishna consciousness starts with envy, matsraya towards his stepbrother. So Narad Muni came at the right point to, you know, correct his mindset. You will not find God with this kind of mindset. Better to purify your mind, you know, to some stage, and then pursue your bhakti. If we oppose this, Duryodhana was also very highly ambitious. He wanted to be the king, and he was working, you know, day and night in achieving his goals. But his ambition was afflicted with envy. He wanted to be the king, and he wanted not somebody else to be the king. And actually, he wanted those who actually deserved to be the king, the Pandavas, not to be the kings, firstly. Secondly, he also wanted to get rid of them, get out of this place, as Dhruva said. Dhruva, another Dhruva, no? One Dhruva is correcting another Dhruva. So, you know, as he said, just he wanted Pandavas to be pretty much killed as well. So similar attitude we can see here from Suruchi's point of view. She knows that in future there will be a king when Uttanapad leaves his body. So therefore my son Uttama should be the king. So Dhruva should be ill-treated right from the beginning only, and to the point that she tells him to go and die. So same thing with Duryodhana as well. Very, very ill mindset, envious person. So ambition filled with envy can be very, very disastrous. And we saw the disaster that unfolded with Duryodhana. So, in Dhruva's pastime, we saw that he channelized his anger towards bhakti. He could have taken some wrong steps in trying to take or seek revenge from Uttama, his stepbrother. But what he actually did, you know, with the good counseling of his mother, he started perceiving Krishna consciousness at the age of 5. You know. And he managed to channelize his... He went through a very, very hard time. And I've already explained to you, you know, the triple whammy that happened to him. You know, being disrespected by the mother, being not protected by his father, being hurt, you know, his heart pierced with, you know, very, very harsh words. He kind of tolerated this and then channelized into Krishna consciousness. Now, Pandavas also went through many austerities in their life. You know, many, many troubles and difficulties they went through. But with each of those adversities, they came out stronger and stronger and stronger in their Krishna consciousness. Similarly, we as sadhakas also go through these pains in our life. And the pain can be very, very, can be on a subtle, not on a subtle, on an emotional level, you know, when we are hurt like this by our loved ones, you know, by our by devotee friends, you know. Or it can be very physical as well, you know. We are hurt, injuries and all that. Generally, at this point in time in Kali Yuga, this tends to be a little bit lesser of a problem, especially if you are in Melbourne. Now, somebody being hurt by walking on the street and all those things are very, very minimal. Our biggest pain in the world tends to be very emotional. Now, stress is the number one killer in the world. So we are very stressed because of, you know, family relationships, because of friend relationships, you know, being hurt by friends, because of office relationships, you know, being told off on and time again by the boss, too much stressful deadline. So this causes all these emotional and subtle pains. So we go through all this. So we can take a page out of Dhruva's biography of how he channelized his anger and pain into Krishna consciousness. And we all know, when we fast forward the story, that the Lord gave darshan to Dhruva. Now, after 6 months of his intense austerity, Krishna appeared in front of Dhruva and gave him the blessing. And Krishna not only fulfilled his material desire, and his material desire was what? I want a palace that is even more exalted than the palace of my father. And not only that, I want a palace that is the most exalted in the entire three worlds. In other words, that he says, I don't want a palace that is only as big and bigger than my father, but also bigger than my forefathers and my great-grandfather. Brahma is initially the lineage. So he says, I want something that is even more opulent than what Lord Brahma has got. Krishna says, Tathastu. No, I'll give it to you. When Dhruva gets purified, then Dhruva says, I don't want this. Srila Prabhupada explains that Dhruva's meditation was, I was looking for broken pieces of glass, my Lord. I don't want that now that I have got this, diamonds. What is the value of broken pieces of glass when I found you, which is diamond? So, of course, he got purified through the process of the chanting, the mantra that was given to him. So, as Dhruva channelized his anger and his injury and his Kshatriya temperament into pursuing his Krishna consciousness, when we are in pain and trials and tribulations, we can know that these are the stepping stones to our Krishna consciousness. We should not waste our pain. We should not waste our pain. When there are pain in life, we should find ways of connecting more and more to Krishna. To say, oh my dear Lord, you are very beautiful and I'm looking for all these broken pieces of glass in my life. Why am I such a fool? Please give me the intelligence whereby I can pursue my ambition of whatever gift you have given me, as the talent, Whatever you have given me as a talent is your gift to me. My dear Lord, whatever you have given me as a talent is your gift to me. How I use that talent is my gift to you. So, oh my dear Lord, please give me that intelligence whereby I can pursue my ambition of whatever talent you have given me, whatever skill you have given me, and purify my consciousness so that I can use this as a contribution towards you, as a contribution towards other devotees, as a contribution towards developing or growing Krishna consciousness and reaching out to all else, or everybody else who is also in similar pain like Dhruva Maharaj. How can I reach their heart? Please give me that intelligence. And rest assured, just as Narad Muni appeared in the life of Dhruva Maharaj when he was praying sincerely like that, somebody will appear in our life from time to time. We have got our own spiritual master, of course. But even at every stage, my spiritual master can be very away from here. You can contact him with emails and all that. But somebody will, some devotee will come in your life when we are sincerely praying to the Lord, and he will give you the direction or the correction to say, this is how we approach Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is very beautiful. He's very far more beautiful than anything else that we can ask. Far more beautiful than any palace that we can aim for. If Dhruva Maharaj at the end of his Krishna consciousness wanted to reject the greatest opulence that was given to him, Dhruva Loka, then what is the value of our one house in Truganina or in Tanit, or in Varibi or somewhere? What is the value? So our mindset, our ambition can be purified if we sincerely beg at the lotus feet of the Lord to say, I want something, Lord. I want you, because you are very beautiful and that's all I want. Please help me in achieving you. When Kunti Maharani, and I'll end with this, when Kunti Maharani went through all these adversities at the end of Kurukshetra, to the point then when the five children of the Pandavas Draupadi was killed. Even after all that, when Krishna is about to leave Vrindavan for Dwarka, and that's the famous prayers of Queen Kunti. Now, Srila Prabhupada wrote this book, The Prayers of Queen Kunti, which is in first canto, chapter 8. Kunti Maharani is saying, and we all know this now, that, oh my Lord, let these calamities come again and again and again in my life, because these calamities help me remember you. But before that, what she says, that, oh my Lord, you are so beautiful. And the prayer she offers is that, Namo Pankajana Bhaya, Namo Pankajana Maline, Namo Pankajane Traya, Namaste Pankaja Angraha. So what is she saying? That Namo Pankaja Nabhaya. Oh my Lord, your navel is so beautiful. Your waist is so beautiful. Namo Pankaja Malini. The garland that you are wearing is so beautiful. Namo Pankaja Netraya. Your eyes are so beautiful. Pankaja means lotus. Your eyes are like a lotus. Your belly is like lotus flowers. Your flowers are made of a lotus. Your garland is made of a lotus flowers. Your eyes are like lotus flowers. Namo Pankaja Angrahe. Namaste Pankaja Angrahe. And your feet is lotus. Beautiful like lotus. So, Krishna is beauty personified top to bottom. And when we take shelter of such a beautiful personality, then everything else is immaterial. So with that vision, no, of aiming for something that is so beautiful in life, that will give us all the pleasure. Krishna is not only the source of, Krishna is not only the reservoir of pleasure, He is also the source of pleasure. He holds all the pleasure and He generates all the pleasure. So whatever pain is there, and if you want to extinguish it with pleasure, with bliss, then Krishna is the shelter for us. So with that, you know, we aim for the our best. No? We aim for, we may not become the best in anything, but we should always aim to be, to do our best. There's a difference between being the best and doing our best. No? So we may not be the best, but we should always aim to do the best. Is that okay? Any questions? Yes, ma'am. Yeah, maybe one, and then we'll open it to others. If they don't have it, then I'll come back to you. Is that okay?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the first one is, I have trouble understanding how this king can let his wife stand over him so much to decide what's going with the kingdom. What sort of king is he?
Okay, so the question is, you know, why did King Uttanapad in this case acted like this? And what kind of king is he when he is not able to... correct his wife? So, it is not uncommon to find kings who are not saintly. King is a position, and time to time I find kings that are get appointed through natural heredity or through nepotism, and they might not be saintly. And famous example that we have got is from our own Bhagavad Gita. King Dhritarashtra is not saintly at all. No? So he's a king. He's no different from Uttanapad. He's probably even worse than Uttanapad. No, he's not suitable for a king, but he happens to be in that point till certain point in time, and that's why the whole Kurukshetra is taking place to remove the unsaintly kings. Krishna tells us in Bhagavad Gita, maybe chapter 4, evam parampara, maybe 4, I'm not sure, evam parampara praptam imam raj rishiyo vidhu sakale neha mata yogo nasta parantapa. So I get this knowledge of Krishna consciousness through parampara, which we know, disciplic succession, to the saintly kings. Evam parampara praptam imam raj rishiyo vidhu. So there is Raja, which is the king. Raja means king, and Rishi means saint. So I give this knowledge to the saintly kings. And when the kings become unsaintly, that is why yada yada hi dharmasya. Krishna comes to get rid of these non-saintly kings, and then restore the saintly kings. So in this case, Uttanapad is certainly not saintly. Otherwise, firstly, he will not have a favorite wife. If you have two wives, then you do justice to both. So you won't have a favorite wife. Secondly, no, you will not, as a king, he should not have seen the ill treatment of Dhruva Maharaj. He wouldn't have allowed that. And another lesson learned out of this is a very good question, but I'll just jump to another lesson, beautiful lesson. As we know, that the genesis for Dhruva Maharaj's austerity was to take revenge from his brother Uttama, and also from his mother, stepmother, Surichi, and from his father, Uttanapad. But in the process of him chanting the mantra that was given to him and becoming purified, what does he do? He not only regrets his material motive to want something that is bigger than, you know, even Lord Brahma. That's the first regret he has got. Secondly, excuse me, when he comes back home after becoming a pure devotee, he's not envious at his family at all. So when Dhruva returns home, which is the next chapter, Dhruva returns home is titled, there are all these personalities running towards Dhruva's arrival. The first person that Dhruva goes and pays obeisances to is Mother Surichi, his stepmother, who had pierced his heart. Now see the role of a devotee, the mood of a devotee. When he was not a devotee, or the beginning stages, you know, he was full of Matsreya. But when he becomes pure devotee, fully Krishna conscious, he is Nirmatsraya. No, he is no longer envious towards Mother Surichi. And what does Mother Surichi do? She hugs Dhruva tightly, you know, and welcomes him with all joy and bliss, and showers all affection towards his stepson, if you like. Why? Dhruva has got purified because he has been chanting Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudeva. He has taken darshan of the Lord. The Lord has put conch on his head. So all his sins have fully been eradicated. So he is a pure devotee. A pure devotee is Pandita Samadarshina. Right? So he sees everybody equally. From Dhruva's point of view, we can understand. But why did Mother... what was the trigger of the change in Mother Surichi towards Dhruva? And the answer is, a devotee, especially a pure devotee, everybody is very dear to him. Krishna tells us in Bhagavad Gita. And a devotee, pure devotee is also very dear to everybody else. So because he's a pure devotee, Mother Surichi is automatically now attracted to Dhruva. Second person then he hugs, is his stepbrother, Uttama. Dhruva and Uttama, when they hug each other very tightly, you know, there's so much of brotherly bonding between them. Same thing. They all, because one person in the family got purified fully, and Srila Prabhupada tells us, that generates the ability to purify, you know, many generations above and below and at the same level. So here we saw the whole family got purified just by the austerity of one soul in the family. And that's a very good lesson for us. When we become fully focused on our Krishna consciousness, you know, we have got that ability or that vibe that we can create, that will also generate that wavelength, you know, to everybody that we are surrounded by. Our kith and kin, you know, our friends, our office, we carry that vibe. And Srila Prabhupada showed that, you know, when he was traveling, everybody was attracted to him because he's a pure devotee. Even if they didn't know him, they were attracted to him. So, yes, there's a lesson. But answer to your question, you know, why did king act according, like this? Because he was not a saintly king.
Okay, so the second question to that, why the king acted like that, is Dhruva seemed very intelligent for a young boy.
Yeah.
Determined,
yeah.
But yet he couldn't understand that it wasn't worth to sit on this pilgrimage for me, whether he was his father or not. Why he didn't just reject it and say, thank you very much for letting me out of this? Because
yeah.
He's got so much intelligence, I thought he would realize this person is not worth to sit on his knee.
Understand. So the second question is, for those of you who are listening on audio as well, you know. The question is, when given that Dhruva is so intelligent, why did he even bother trying to sit on the lap of his father, knowing that the father was kind of, you know, not the best of the fathers, so just rejected? And why did he want to continue to aspire to sit on the lap of the father? Two things. One, it's, as I explained already, it's natural for a son to approach his father. So in that way, he approached his father to sit on the lap. It's natural behavior. So that's how it started. When the king rejected him and didn't correct his wife, when Dhruva goes and prays with this adulterated motive of trying to find Krishna consciousness, at that point in time, it's not necessary that he was pursuing all that to sit on the lap of the father. Because he tells Narad Muni that I'm full of anger at the moment, you know. And anger means what? Revenge. I want to take revenge. Why do I want something bigger than my father so that I can tell him I'm also made up of something mighty? No. You rejected me and with all these opponents now you come and, you know, reject me. Now Dhruva might not have done all this. He's only a 5-year-old boy. But it is not unusual for a little boy to think like this. That I won. Sometimes, you know, when we have kids at home and when we are trying to, you know, correct them, and the child is 4 or 5 years old, he'll says, "Ah, you're the worst father in the whole world." We go through that. And sometimes, you know, our kids tell us, "You are the best parent ever." Or another day they will say, "You are the worst parents, you know, we could ever have." I know one devotee was telling me that his son is praying that, "Oh Krishna, please purify my father." So it's not unnatural, see. But then when he becomes pure devotee, then he's no longer inimical towards his whole family, whether they are his biological or his, you know, step. Yeah? Sorry, a bit louder so everybody else can also hear, please. Just a little bit louder.
I say again now, it's not the usual child because of what he's done. Anybody's usual child is not going to do this, so it's not the usual child.
Yeah.
He's special for a start. He's
yeah.
got special intelligence.
Yeah.
So I just wondered how come he couldn't understand. It must be the play out of the sleeve so we can discuss him.
Yeah, it's a play of the Supreme. The point is that the question was that why couldn't he get the intelligence of, you know, when he was so intelligent, why did he not get that intelligence to taking the right path immediately? And the answer is, he of course took the right path immediately. He took to Krishna consciousness. Now, he started with the wrong motive, if you like, but he still took to the Krishna consciousness. He approached the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Huh? Yeah.
Understand. So why not just go on to what he was
going to do? Yeah, well, as I said, you know, there could be many things, and one of them is that he took to the Lord, so that's a right path in his own. But in terms of why he immediately didn't do that, maybe we have to go to Dhruva Loka to check with him. I don't know. You'll have to ask Dhruva Maharaj that question. When it's about mindset, then I can't read his mind. But I can tell you what the scriptures, what the Acharyas explain in the scriptures. Okay. Anything else? Yes, Prabhu. Heman Prabhu, yeah.
When you were talking about ambitions, you know, most of the time ambitions, like material ambitions come when you start comparing with other people, okay, and the person has achieved that. How to stop comparing when it comes to people with
that? Yeah. So, Heman Prabhu's question is that, you know, sometimes when we pursue our material desires, then we also start comparing with somebody else. Know that I might be inferior or superior to you, and then how to stop that kind of mindset of comparing. So, as I said, firstly, we should not be proud of. Let's go two steps back. You know, when we are talking about desires, you know, Krishna tells us that intelligence. Krishna gives us that intelligence. You know. Krishna is the ability in man. Krishna tells us in Bhagavad Gita chapter 7 that Paurusham Rishu. I am the ability in man. So first we have to be cognizant that that ability or the talent that we have got itself is Krishna's gift to us, nothing else. So if that gift is from us and now we are trying to compare to somebody else, then if you draw that triangle, if you like, that there is Krishna, there is my desire and there is somebody else's desire and he is growing at his pace, I am growing at his pace. But the moment we have got that central pivot of that everything is coming from Krishna, then moment we connect to Krishna, then we know that he is progressing at the pace that Krishna is allowing him and he is sincerely endeavoring, and I am also progressing at the pace that I am capable of. But both of our goal is Krishna. Then there is no inimical, there is no animosity between us and other person. Whether he is slower or faster than us, will still be very, very congratulatory towards that person. Because the ability comes from Krishna, the goal is Krishna, then where is the need to be, you know, mine versus yours? Because Surichi's problem is my son versus your son. But the moment we see that everybody is Krishna's son and all of us are coming back to our Supreme Father, then there is no animosity. Second thing is then, as I said, you know, Krishna has given us this gift. Somehow or the other we have to actualize these gifts and talents he has given us as our gift back to him. So he is offering his Pushpam Patram Phalam Toyam and his talents. I am offering my Pushpam Patram Phalam Toyam with my talents. So both of us are only offering it back to Krishna. Then where is the point of being inimical? Third thing is, when our desires come to mind, to say, I want to pursue this desire, you know, and he wants to pursue his desire, I want to outrun him, so that I achieve my goals quicker than him, so I can little bit show off, you know, that I'm better than you, like that. We have to be very careful that to filter our desires. Knowledge means not only at the moment what is happening. In the universities, we are all bombarded with knowledge. Yeah, and now they are running out of ideas because there is no longer a need for the knowledge to be memorized. Why? Because everything is on Google. And everything is on Google. We came through a school stream of everything being crammed in the head. Memorize this, vomit it on the exam paper, forget it. But now this model does not work anymore because kids don't need to memorize anything. It's already there. They don't have to write anything because it can be projected. And they don't have to memorize because Google is there with your smartphone. Why do I need to know the spelling of this word? Because Google or the Microsoft Word will auto-spell correct it anyway. Why do I need to know the spelling? So they are running ideas of how to teach a child, a children. So firstly, they have failed on this. Secondly, the knowledge that is given is all about what? Consumerism. Get this knowledge, get a job, buy this thing and you'll be happy. Full consumerism society, yeah? For those who are from Indian background, you know, you will understand it. Now, somebody said that our society today is made up of consumer. Why consumer? Because consume and mar. Mar means to die, you know, in Hindi. So consumer, consume and mar. So it's all about knowledge to consume, consume, consume. But knowledge means two things. From a philosophical point of view, knowledge means to know how to fulfill our desires, firstly. Secondly, to know which desires to fulfill. At the moment, the focus is only on one set, how to fulfill your desires. That is okay. But proper intelligence means also to know which desires to fulfill. So when desires run in our mind like that incessant flow of waters flowing into the ocean, Krishna tells us in Bhagavad Gita, you know, there is continuous flow of water into the ocean, but the ocean becomes sthita pragya. You know, it's very, very stable. You know, it doesn't transgress its laws of the boundary. So similarly, when these desires come in our mind, we have to filter which desires I will pursue, which desires I will not pursue. It's like that antivirus software. When you have got this, you know, your laptop, then we have to have that strong antivirus software. Because the antivirus software will detect which is virus, discard it, which is not virus, which software, then let it come into the mainstream. Yeah? So our mind has to be, you know, like that antivirus software. So it can deduce which one is virus, check it out, which is the inferiority complex with somebody else comparing. And then also, you know, to progress with those desires that are favorable to our Krishna consciousness. Anukulasya sankalpya, pratikulasya varjanam, Krishna tells us. So what is not favorable for our Krishna consciousness, reject it, those desires. What is favorable for our Krishna consciousness, accept it. Yeah. Okay. Anything else? No. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada. Gantra Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki. Tagore Prabhupada.